Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Thanks for joining us here on the RTC Weekly Download. I'm Jim Dolan, your host, popping in here every so often to present some great old-time radio shows. We're going to start off with the Halls of Fantasy, and this is called The Black Figurine of Death. This is from 1953. And in about 30 minutes, we'll be back with Grantland Rice story. That's about football's beloved Canute Rockne.
The Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the series of radio dramas dedicated to the supernatural, the unusual, and the unknown. Come with me, my friends. We shall descend to the world of the unknown and forbidden, down to the depths where the veil of time is lifted and the supernatural reigns as king. Come with me and listen to the tale of the Black Figurine of Death.
Is that you, David?
Yes, I heard a shot.
So did we.
I thought it was one of you.
It was Sawyer.
He came out late tonight. I found him out in the mausoleum about an hour ago.
Here's his room.
Try the door.
It's open.
He's on the floor.
Is he?
Yes. He's dead.
Now for our story, an original tale of fantasy by Richard Thorne entitled The Black Figurine of Death. Through all the years of man's existence, no matter what he has learned or been taught from generation to generation, still he carries in the innermost depths of his mind a certain fear of the darkness, a fear of the night, which is somehow associated with death, and which in actuality is the fear of death itself. Each of us in his lifetime will probably come in contact with some psychic phenomenon, either directly or indirectly through the experience of a relative or acquaintance. An experience never to be forgotten. And about such an experience is my story tonight. I was there with the others the night he died. We stood at the foot of the bed, Joyce and Harold and I. Amos Jansen's head was cushioned on a pillow, and in his hand he held a little figurine.
You sent for us, Uncle Amos?
Of course I did. Otherwise you wouldn't be here in my room, Harold.
No, Uncle Amos is no...
Be quiet! Be quiet, all of you. You're here too, David.
Yes, sir, I...
I didn't ask for a speech, young man. I'll do the talking if you don't mind. I must speak to all of you while I still have time.
Why don't you rest, Uncle Amos?
Rest? You'd like to see that, wouldn't you, Joyce? David and Harold. What? No answer from any of you? I know why you can't say anything, because it's the truth.
Now, see here, Uncle Amos.
Go listen to me, young man. These last years of my life, you've all left me alone. You've had more important things to do. That is, until tonight. Ah, tonight you're all here because you know I'm dying. You've come here like a pack of wolves, waiting for me to die, waiting for your chance to inherit my estate.
Oh, that's not true, Uncle Amos.
Oh, isn't it? I think it is. Don't worry. You'll inherit the estate, the three of you. But in the end, you'll wish you never had.
What do you mean, Uncle Amos?
That though I die, you'll see me again. All of you who've hated me. Know of my presence when you see this.
Oh, that's just a little figurine, Uncle Amos.
You'll wish you'd never seen it before I'm through. You'll wish that you'd never known me, that you'd never been born. Before you die, you'll all learn what fear is. You'll learn how it feels to be... feel to be... alone.
Uncle Amos!
He's dead, Joyce.
Oh, no. Oh, no, he can't be.
He He's dead, all right.
What's that?
Something dropped out of his hand. Why? It's the little figurine.
The little figurine lay there on the floor. It had fallen from Uncle Amos's hand just as he died. And when it struck the floor, it had broken into three pieces. I picked them up and held them in my hand. The pieces fitted together perfectly, much like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. It was a queer little figure, its arms raised in supplication, a look of fear upon its face. There was something frightening about it. 3 days later, Uncle Amos was buried in the family mausoleum at the north end of the estate. A week after that, we had gathered again in the library of the old house with Carl Sawyer, the executor of the estate.
As you know, your uncle appointed me as executor of the estate and left instructions that the three main heirs, 10 days following his demise, be gathered together in this house for a reading of the will.
You told us that earlier, Mr. Sawyer.
So I did. Are you all seated comfortably?
Quite comfortably, Mr. Sawyer.
It's a rather long will, you know. Now, I shall begin. I, Amos Johnson, being of sound mind and body, do make, ordain, and publish this instrument as my last will and testament.
Mr. Sawyer, why don't you just tell us about the will?
That's a rather unusual procedure, David.
Well, David's right, Mr. Sawyer. It'll save a lot of time and trouble.
Well, perhaps you're right. Let me see. Now, referring to the disposition of the monies and property, it's to be divided equally amongst the three of you. Of course, there are certain gifts to the servants.
Naturally.
Yes, naturally. There is a considerable amount of money to be divided, even after taxes. Each of you will be independent for life.
Well, I can't understand Uncle Amos willing us the entire estate. The night he died...
Contrary to what you may think, your Uncle Amos was really quite fond of you.
Is that all to the will, Mr. Sawyer?
No. Of course you realize that if one of you were to die, his or her share of the estate would be divided between the two remaining heirs. And there is one other proviso which I cannot quite understand.
Yes?
Your uncle made one condition referring to the disposition of the monies. Let me see if I can find that. Yes. Here it is. May I read it, please? The heirs are to reside in the family house on the estate for a period of 1 year. If this is not done, their claim to the estate is to be nullified, and they are to be left without a penny. Unfortunately, they were present very infrequently during the last years of my life.
Well, that's a rather strange provision.
Yes, isn't it? However, as executor of your uncle's will, it is up to me to make sure the provisions are carried out. And believe me, I feel a deep sense of duty to your late uncle.
The four of us discussed the will until the early hours of the morning. We persuaded Sawyer to spend the night with us, to return to the city in the morning. The house became quite silent, and the only sound I heard was the ticking of the clock on my dresser. I wondered about the provision of the will in which Uncle Amos ordered that we make our residence in his house. I was lying awake in bed thinking of that when... Standing outside my door in the hallway was the housekeeper.
Mr. David?
Yes, Emily.
I found this in my bedroom tonight.
Oh, let me see it.
Here.
Mm-hmm. It's a little black figurine, just like the one my uncle had. Hmm. You can have it back now, Emily.
It frightened me, so I came to you, Mr. David.
How do you think it got there, Emily?
There's something strange going on in this house, Mr. David. And I have an idea. I know who's in bed.
Who's talking out there? Oh, it's you, David. And Emily. You're up rather late, aren't you?
Yes, Mr. Sawyer. I was just going to bed. If you'll excuse me.
Good night, Emily.
Good night, sir. I'll see you in the morning.
Well, I suppose I'd better get back to bed, too. Good night, David.
Good night, Mr. Sawyer. I watched him go back into his room. Then I turned and went back into mine. Emily had been on the point of saying something to me,
something that was important enough to her to make a special trip to my room. I got back into bed and wondered what she'd wanted to tell me. Little by little, sleep clouded my brain. And I was half asleep.
Back now to our tale of fantasy entitled The Black Figurine of Death.
I had been just on the point of falling asleep.
No! Slayer, I heard someone scream.
So did I, David.
I almost think I heard something.
I know I did. There's David and Mr. Sawyer. Maybe they can tell us what happened. Did you two hear anything?
It was a scream. First, I thought it might have been you, Joyce.
I think it came from the servants' quarters.
Emily.
What did you say, David?
It'll keep. Come on. Do you think it was the housekeeper, David?
It has to be.
Maybe she was just startled or something.
Well, we'll see in a moment.
No, that's your room, just down the hall.
I hope it's nothing serious.
It was serious enough to make her scream. Emily! Emily, is anything wrong?
Well, try the door, David.
Right. It's unlocked.
The light's on in there.
She's not in bed. She's...
Oh, on the floor!
Maybe she fainted.
No. She's dead.
And look, right beside her, there's a little broken black figurine.
Though the police came out and went over everything, there were no clues to follow. They said that Emily had been strangled, but there was nothing to indicate who might have done it. The police continued their investigation for almost a month. But at the end of that time, all they could write down in their case book was... murder. Unsolved. One evening, about 6 weeks after Emily's death, Harold, Joyce, and I were in the living room.
The police said they'd never be able to find out who did it unless something new turned up.
And it probably won't.
Oh, the whole thing frightens me. I still remember Uncle Amos's dying words. That though I die, you'll see me again. All of you who have hated me. And you'll know of my presence when you see this. Oh, it makes me shudder every time I think of it.
I've been thinking about what he said, too, Joyce. I wonder if he could come back.
You mean come back after death?
Yes.
Don't be a fool, Harold. Once a man dies, he's dead.
Is he? I'm not so sure of that.
You shouldn't talk that way, Harold. It's frightening.
Would you come out with me to the mausoleum, Dave?
Why?
I don't know. I just want to check, that's all.
Well, I don't think either of you should go.
I'll go, Harold.
Well, I won't.
That's all right, Joyce. I won't expect you to. All right, David, let's go. I've always had an interest in the supernatural, David. You know, there's certain things that happen, psychic phenomena, which have no normal or natural explanation.
I've never seen any.
Nor have I. But what's to say that Uncle Amos can't return? Oh, do you have the key?
Yeah.
Open the door.
It's a good thing we brought these flashlights.
Yes, it's pretty dark in there. Shall we go in?
I guess so. I still don't see any reason for coming in here, Harold.
There may not be. Then again...
he's in that crypt over there. Nothing's been disturbed in here. It looks just like it did the day he was placed here.
Just a minute.
This wasn't here the day he was buried.
What?
This?
That's strange. I didn't see that when I came in.
You probably weren't looking over there. I wasn't either.
Another little black figurine. Broken just like the others. It gave me an eerie sensation. The little figure was broken into three pieces. I looked at Harold, and he seemed to be as afraid as I was. We locked up the mausoleum again and went back to the house. By that time, I began to wonder if perhaps Uncle Amos was striking back at us from beyond the grave. We said goodnight about 11 and retired to our rooms.
couldn't get to sleep. I'd fall into a half-doze and then snap out of it again. I felt as if someone were watching me. That there were unseen eyes in the dark waiting for me to fall asleep. I knew it was only my imagination. Yet that feeling would not go away. About 3 o'clock, I got out of bed. I decided to return to the mausoleum. As I went out the front door, I noticed a light drizzle had sprung up. Something drew me toward the mausoleum, a compulsion, an inner force over which I had absolutely no control. I walked slowly up the gravel walk leading to the mausoleum, not even noticing the light rain which fell on me. When I was close enough to see the doorway, I received a distinct shock, for the door was open, and there was a circle of light behind it. I walked to the door. I tried to get through the door quietly, but I jarred it a little, and the noise made the man inside whirl around. In his hand, he held a gun.
David! What are you doing here?
I might ask you the same question, Mr. Sawyer. I had gone into the mausoleum. Standing there with a gun in his hand was the executor of the estate, Carl Sawyer.
David! What are you doing here?
I might ask you the same question, Mr. Sawyer.
I began to wonder. I don't believe in people coming back after they die, but...
Is that the reason for the gun?
I didn't know what I'd find. I wanted to be safe, that's all. Now that I see it's you, I'll put it back in my pocket. By the way, David, what are you doing out here?
I was restless. Harold thinks everything that's happened has some supernatural significance. All his talk made me nervous.
I see. And do you think that there is something supernatural about the way Emily died?
I don't know, Mr. Sawyer. I just don't know. Sawyer and I returned to the house. I asked him to spend the remainder of the night with us. Besides, I wanted to keep an eye on him. I didn't feel much like sleeping, so I went down to the library, picked out a book, and sat down to read.
David?
Yes?
Mr. Sawyer told me you were down here. What's the matter?
I can't sleep.
David, I talked to Mr. Sawyer for almost 10 minutes. He said he thinks that you're in back of everything.
What did you say to that?
I told him I thought he was wrong.
Thanks for your confidence, Joyce.
The more I think about it, the more I think that Harold's right in what he says.
You mean that Uncle Amos has come back to life?
Yes.
I'd keep an eye on Sawyer if I were you.
Do you think he's in back of it?
I'm not sure.
But you must have some reason for it.
I went out to the mausoleum tonight about an hour ago. Sawyer was out there. He had a gun in his hand.
He told me he was just curious.
Why should he suddenly get curious at 3 o'clock in the morning?
It does seem rather odd that he...
No!
Would be...
Stay away from me! I'm warning you! Stay away from me!
That was Sawyer. Come on.
It couldn't happen again. It just couldn't.
We'll see.
Is that you, David?
Yes.
I heard a shot.
Well, so did we.
I thought it was one of you.
It was Sawyer.
He came out late tonight. I found him out in the mausoleum about an hour ago.
Here's his room.
Try the door.
It's open.
On the floor.
Is he? Yes. He's dead.
Sawyer lay there on the floor, sprawled in the grotesque position of death. By one outstretched hand was a gun, and by the other, broken into 3 pieces, was a little black figurine. Harold called the police. They said they'd be out as soon as they could. The three of us went downstairs to the living room. I was right.
It is Uncle Amos who's behind it.
It must be. There's no other explanation.
I told you before that there are certain things which can never be explained.
The deaths of Emily and Sawyer prove that.
You don't still think that Sawyer was in back of it, do you, David?
Hardly. Will or no will, I'm leaving here now. I'm not going to stay around here and be killed like the others. I'm going upstairs and pack. I'll be down in a while.
I'm going to leave too, David. What about you?
I don't know. I still can't make myself believe it.
David!
Stay here.
Oh, no, no, I'll go with you. If Harold's dead, I...
He has to be all right. Harold! Harold!
He doesn't answer.
Harold! Where are you?
Harold! Harold, answer us!
His door's open.
He'll be dead. He'll be dead just like the others.
No, Joyce, he's not here.
The mausoleum. Uncle Amos came and took him back to the mausoleum.
I went into Sawyer's room. Harold wasn't there, nor was Sawyer's gun. I supposed that Harold had picked it up on his way to the room. I decided to go out to the mausoleum to see if Joyce was right, to see if Harold's dead body would be found there. Joyce wouldn't remain in the house alone, so together we started out through the rain-filled night.
Why don't we wait until the police come, Dave?
If this is something supernatural, then they wouldn't be able to help us anyway.
David.
What's the matter?
The mausoleum door's open.
You can stay here if you want. I'm going in.
No, I'll go with you.
Stay close to me, Joyce.
I will. I don't like it in here, David.
Neither do I. But you're going to remain here for some time.
David!
That was Harold's voice. That's right. But turn the flashlight on. You can see me then.
But we thought you were...
Dead? Hardly. But you two will be very soon.
Here's a gun, David.
That's right, Sawyer's gun. Plan this very carefully, David. When the police arrive, they'll find the three of you dead, and I'll be wounded. Tell them that Sawyer was behind it all, that he killed both of you out here, and that he came into the house searching for me. It was a fight. The gun went off, and he died.
Then you killed Emily and Sawyer?
Yes. Going to kill both of you, too. You don't think I believed all that hokum I fed you about Uncle Amos coming back, do you? Of course not. But it served its purpose. And now you'll serve yours.
Harold. Harold, look out in back of you.
How stupid do you think I am?
Uncle Amos is coughing. It's slipping.
Get out of the way, Harold.
Get out of the way.
He's dead, Joyce.
Uncle Amos.
What did you say?
Remember what Uncle Amos said when he was dying? That he'd come back and settle with us. The coffin. I wonder if it was just an accident that it slipped out of the crypt. Or whether Uncle Amos really did come back.
So runs the tale of the Black Figurine of Death.
All characters and events portrayed on these programs are fictitious, and any similarity to actual places or persons living or dead is purely coincidental. Featured in this program were Harry Elders as David Jensen, Richard Thorne as Harold Jensen, Eloise Cummer as Joyce Jensen, and Claire Baum as Carl Sawyer. Original music moods were created and performed by Harold Turner. Sound effects by Wayne Dickinson and Lloyd Knight. Your announcer is George Bauer. These programs are directed by Leroy Alliger, written and produced by Richard Thorne.
Now we're on to Grantland Rice, the Grantland Rice story, and he told stories of sports and related topics. The program's from 1955, and it's football's beloved Knute Rockne.
time for yours truly, Jimmy Powers, with another Grantland Rice story. Hello again. This is Jimmy Powers, transcribed with another chapter from Granny Rice's life story, The Tumult and the Shouting. Today's chapter gives us another penetrating look at Newt Rockne, who made Notre Dame a byword for the best in college football throughout America. So, with a nod to the ever-young spirit of Grantland Rice, I take up his narrative once again in first person. Newt Rockne was a great man of force, deep charm, and an amazing personality. Whenever there was a gathering of coaches in any city, there was usually just one question. Where's Rockstane? That's where they all gathered. There have been so many fine coaches, such great inventors as Pop Warner, Lonnie Stagg, and Bob Zupke, that no one can pick the greatest. But Rockne had the greatest of all in the way of human appeal. It was in 1928 that Rock brought perhaps his least successful Irish team to New York to meet a splendid Army 11 that featured Red Cagle, a great runner who could handle a halfback slot on anybody's all-time team. Friday night before the game, Rock called me at our flat. "Grant," he said, "the boys are tucked in for the night. How about coming down to the hotel? We need a crying towel." "Better still," I replied, "hop in a cab and come up here. We can warm our sides by an open fire, have a spot of Tennessee milk, and watch the rest of the world go hang." That evening, sitting by the fire, Rock said that he expected to be up against it but good next day. "You recall my greatest back, George Gipp," said Rock. "Well, he died practically in my arms 8 years ago next month. He's been gone a long time, but I may have to use him again tomorrow." "You saw Gipp on one of his better days against Army in 1920, continued Rock in a quiet, hushed tone. "Gipp fell sick later that same season. In our final against Northwestern at Evanston, he climbed out of bed to make the trip. I used him very little that day. We were away and winging. The final was 33-7. But in the last quarter, the stands chanted Gipp's name so loud and long that I finally sent him in for a few plays on that ice-covered field with the wind off Lake Michigan cutting us all to the bone. I got him out of there quick, but after returning to school with a raging fever, Gipp went back to his sick bed. He never got up. Pneumonia had him back to his own goal line. He lived barely 2 weeks. Shortly before he went, Father Pat Haggerty baptized him into the church. After the little ceremony, I sat with him on his bed. Gipp's face seemed thinner than the communion wafer he had just taken and just as white, but his forehead was strangely cool. Gipp looked up at me, and after a moment he said, "Rock, I know I'm going, but I'd like one last request. Someday, Rock, sometime when the going isn't so easy, when the odds are against us, ask a Notre Dame team to win a game for me, for the Gipper. I don't know where I'll be then, Rock, but I'll know about it, and I'll be happy." A moment later, Gipp was gone. Then Rock added, "I've never asked the boys to pull one out for Gipp. Tomorrow I might have to." The following day, that 28 Army-Notre Dame game was played, as always, to an overflow sellout. At the half, it was nothing to nothing. The rest is history. A sobbing band of fighting Irish raced out for the third quarter. when Notre Dame lined up for the kickoff, I knew they were playing with a 12th man, George Gipp. But Red Cagle didn't see any ghost as he circled deep behind his own line, reversed his field, and galloped for great chunks of turf. Cagle's runs and passes carried Army to Notre Dame's 2. There, I recall, a cadet named Murrell plunged over. Bud Sprague, Army's burly tackle, missed the conversion. Notre Dame fired back, smashing and clawing 80 yards, and Jack Chavigny rammed into the end zone, crying, "Here's one of them, Gipper." Next, the Irish end, Johnny O'Brien, a pass-catching, one-play demon, snared a long pass and fell into the end zone for another touchdown to put Notre Dame ahead 12-6. From there on in, Red Cagle put on another one-man stampede, but the gods were riding with Notre Dame that afternoon as the final gun went off with Notre Dame on top, 12-6. Somewhere, George Gipp must have been very happy. Now this is Jimmy Powers once again. My friend Jack Lavelle, one-time Notre Dame guard, recalls his freshman year at South Bend. And with us today is the very personable Lavelle, number one scout for the New York football Giants, and bon vivant of the world at large. Jack, I got a big kick out of your thoughts in Granny's book, but I'd like you to tell us in your own words about the sugar-coated treatment accorded the pea-green freshman at Notre Dame, at least during Rockne's day.
Jimmy, under Rockne there was a saying, freshmen get nothing but abuse and plenty of that. Some of us waited in line for 3 days just to get a uniform. We were very interested in a matter of shoes, and no matter how beat up they were, Mr. Canny always told you, "There you are, freshman, Gip wore these." And it was a toss-up as to who wore more cleats or slept in the most inns, Gip or George Washington.
Jack Lavelle, Granny Rice called Rockne football's greatest salesman, and from the description of those freshman cleats, he must have been. What about his hold over high school coaches? After all of Rock's boys came from high schools around the country.
Well, Jimmy, you had to experience one of Rock's summer football clinics to appreciate the influence he had over high school coaches. Mm-hmm. They swarmed into South Bend or any other place that Rock happened to be at from all over the map, thirsting for some gleanings from the Rockne table of wisdom. From twirling the baton to blowing the tuba, Rockne was the whole show.
Jack, what else do you recall about Rockne or any profile or character study of him? What was the secret of his success, would you say?
Jimmy, I would say the secret of his success was the fact that he was the greatest teacher. Father Newland, who found a very, very ominous poison gas during World War I, and who later found synthetic rubber formula, which Notre Dame has benefited greatly by, he told us many times that Rockne was the greatest organic chemist he had ever known.
Jack, what do you do now that you're no longer at Notre Dame wearing the South Bend Times for inner soles?
Well, the South Bend Times is a happy memory, as you know, Jimmy. I'm with the baseball Giants. I'm doing a lot of promotion work for them and making a lot of novenas.
Well, that's very good. Tell me, would you like to hazard a look into the next 10 years? We've had platoons coming and going, pro football and college football. What's going to be ahead of us?
What the rules committee will do with football, I don't know. But the two-platoon system was put in to help the small school. See? Mm-hmm. Now, a year ago, the two-platoon was rescinded to help the small school. The only thing that'll help the small school, Jimmy, is to get big.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what the ultimate in the rules will be in the next 10 years, as you ask me, I wouldn't know, except that if they don't quit monkeying with the rules, they may not have any game.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fact that they're trying to legislate football. And football is a game to be played by young kids for their college to the best of their ability. And it can't be put through as a matter of law or process of law or anything else.
Isn't that true of all sports? Basketball, they got that 24-second foul shot. In pro basketball, they've been changing the scoring methods of prize fights in 48 different states, and everybody is in a whirl.
Well, I was thinking the other day that if they put any more clocks into basketball, Jimmy, that the commissioner will be an inspector of watches.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there'll be 9 watches around a place, and the guy will only have to know if they're in working order.
Talk about a fast track. Accurate watch?
That's right. And who does it? Which company?
Jack, How about track? That seems to be coming on. Santee and Bannister and whatnot. You were quite a starter and still are. Don't you think that sport is coming on?
Tremendous.
Other sports are dying off a little?
They've left it alone, Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
All you had to do was be faster than the guy and to get there first. And now they got a thing to help the judges find out who's there first.
The teletimer. The photo teletimer.
And then they'll find out pretty soon how to clock them along with it. Mm-hmm. But if they leave a sport alone long enough, Jimmy, for the coaches and the players to get used to what they're doing, it'll be tremendous.
Mm-hmm. Now, everyone asked this question, too, getting back to Rockne. If he were alive today, what do you think he would do? He would be against these changes, or what?
Certainly he'd be against the changes, Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
He'd be against the changes that took anything out of the boys' hands.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if a coach is given a responsibility of coaching a team, that's his.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody can fault him.
Mm-hmm.
If he cannot do the things that a coach is supposed to be able to do, if the boys are not able to play with complete freedom under a normal set of rules, then the game can't be too important.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't changed baseball. They haven't monkeyed around with baseball, and baseball's a terrific game.
Mm-hmm.
They ought to leave it alone, Jimmy, for a while to let everybody get used to it, particularly the spectators.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're commenting on a lot of games. And the spectators, I know we sit home and listen, and the spectators that come into the house say, what is this? What's this? Last year it was like this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's all right. Last year it was. But unfortunately, you have got neither the time nor the amount of script that you need to tell the people the complete changes.
That's right. And it is bewildering. Well, Jack, thanks a lot for this little chat. And fans, that closes the cover of the Tumult and Shouting for today. This is Jimmy Powers, transcribed, saying so long.
We still have some more time this hour, so we now have another short program to do for you. It's called Can You Imagine That? And this is from 1940. This is the $2 million an hour.
A man earns $2 million an hour.
Two famous authors engage in a public fight.
A noted man gets a warm place by the fire through a half a peck of oysters.
Can you imagine that? This is Lindsay McCarry once more, ladies and gentlemen, introducing another session of this series of broadcasts in which we try to dramatize for you some of the more surprising incidents and facts of the world. We'll return in just a moment with the first one. And here's our first item. Sometimes we gasp at the fortunes made and lost overnight in a furious buy and sell flurry in the stock market. But did you ever hear of anyone earning $2 million an hour? Yes, I said $2 million an hour. It staggers the imagination to think of what that might amount to in a year or even a month. Just give me one day like that and I'd be willing to let the rest of the world go by. In fact, I'd buy a few things I've always been wanting. But here's the proof of that amazing statement. Vance Breeze, famous test pilot, once took a plane up for a test dive. He took the ship up to 20,000 feet and dived within 4,000 feet of the ground. The dive took up 15 seconds, for which Vance Breeze was paid $8,000. If you're mathematically inclined, expand those 15 seconds into a minute, which gives you $32,000. Multiply by 60, and you reach the staggering total of nearly $2 million per hour. Can you imagine that? You know, it occurs quite often that two famous men will engage in a feud of words over some bitterly contested difference. But it seldom happens that any two great men will come to a physical encounter. It did happen on one Thursday evening in 1931, March 29 to be exact, within the heavily draped and thickly carpeted walls of the Metropolitan Club in New York City. On that night, Mr. Ray Long, editor of the Cosmopolitan magazine, was entertaining at a banquet in honor of the Russian writer, Mr. Boris Pilnyak. Among those attending were such noble names of letters as Mr. Irvin S. Cobb, Mr. Haywood Broun, Mr. Arthur Brisbane, Mr. Rupert Hughes, Mr. Theodore Dreiser, and Mr. Sinclair Lewis, as well as a rather imposing array of American literary critics. After cigars had been passed and lighted, and as the men of the Fourth Estate sat chatting over their demitasse, their host, Mr. Ray Long, arose and tapped on his glass.
Gentlemen, it is our pleasure this evening to welcome to the metropolis and to America a colleague from across the sea, a man of letters who has come to visit our land from the Union of Socialist Soviet Republics, a man whose fame has long preceded his actual presence among us, Boris Pilnyak. I'm going to assume the privilege of calling upon several of you to welcome this fellow penman in your own way. First, I know you'll be glad to hear a word or two from a gentleman recently from Minnesota. But more recently, winner of the coveted Nobel Prize for Literature, Mr. Sinclair Lewis.
Mr. Long, gentlemen, I'm very happy to meet Mr. Pilnyak, but I do not care to speak in the presence of a man who has plagiarized 3,000 words from my wife's book on Russia. Nor do I care to talk before two sage critics who objected to the Nobel Committee's selection of me as America's representative writer.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Now I'm sure we'll all be glad to hear a few words from that Dean of American Humorists, Mr. Irvin S. Cobb.
Thank you, Mr. Long. I don't know whether I'm dean or not, but one thing I'm certain of is that right now I'd rather be dean than president. Well, I suppose you'll expect a story about the old days down in Paducah,
Wisely calling upon surefire Irvin Cobb, Long saved the situation momentarily. Following Cobb, others paid just tribute to the guest of honor, and at last the banquet adjourned. As small groups gathered to discuss the speeches, two newspaper men assigned to cover the event stood by one of the doors.
Hey, what did Lewis mean by the one man who has plagiarized his wife's book on Russia?
Don't you know? Theodore Dreiser.
What?
Sure, you remember? Dreiser. Say, hey, look.
What's the matter?
There they are. Lewis and Dreiser sitting at that table, talking.
Yeah, man, and how they're talking.
Come on, let's get up a little closer.
Dreiser? You're a liar and a cheat.
For the love of Mike, Dreiser slapping Lewis in the face.
Yes, friends, truly indeed, did Mr. Lewis, Nobel Prize winner, author of Main Street, Babbitt, and Arrowsmith, receive several resounding smacks upon his countenance from the ample palm of portly Mr. Dreiser, Nobel Prize runner-up, author of An American Tragedy, The Genius, and The Hand of the Potter, until the latter was restrained by fellow writers. The next day, remarked Mr. Lewis.
Dreiser's a pretty big fellow. He must weigh close to 200 pounds. I'll bet he could have put up a good scrap if they'd let us go. Still, he's pretty old. Must be 60. You know, he was an established editor in New York when I was just a kid trying to get along. The incident, however, is closed as far as I'm concerned. Can't two men have a private squabble without all this fuss being made over it?
When, after some difficulty, Theodore Dreiser was located at his apartment on 57th Avenue, he made the succinct comment.
It was the proper retort to any insult.
And thus did 1931 witness the amazing progress of belles lettres between two of America's leading writers. Can you imagine that?
God helps those who help themselves.
And that's a saying that's well enough known to everyone, but here's a case where it was put to practical use by the famous American statesman, Benjamin Franklin. It's one of those human interest stories that take the varnish and veneer of legend away from our national heroes and make them just plain human beings like ourselves. It seems that Benjamin Franklin was traveling one night in bitterly cold weather. He reined his horse up in front of a cozy-looking tavern, and one of the hostlers ran up to meet him.
Good evening, sir. It's bitter cold tonight.
Yes, it is. But I suppose I'll be able to thaw the ice from my bones in your tavern here. Looks cozy enough.
Well, I don't know, sir. A lot of others had the same idea. A few of the townsmen are toasting themselves in front of the fire. This saves wood in their own homes.
And no place by the fire for a frozen traveler?
None at all, sir. But you can try. I'll take your horse to the stable, sir.
Thank you, thank you.
Good evening, sir. Good evening.
It's a
bitter cold out there.
Yes, but cozy in here. Warm, with a cheery fire.
Well, I always manage to keep a blaze going, sir, even with times as hard as they are.
I suppose I couldn't find a place by the fire.
Well, no, sir, I the places are all taken.
Well, no matter. But, landlord, you may take a half peck of oysters out for my horse.
A half peck of oysters? For your horse?
A half peck of oysters for my horse.
Very good, sir.
And landlord?
Yes, sir.
On the shell.
Oysters on the shell? For a horse? Bless my soul, I'll get them right away, sir.
Oysters on the shell for a horse.
I'm going out and see the horse eat them.
A seat by the fire. Nothing like it on a cold night.
So Franklin seated himself comfortably in one of the vacated chairs by the fire. But it wasn't long before...
I beg your pardon, sir. I beg your pardon. But your horse won't eat the oysters.
Oh, won't he? Well, no matter now. Just bring them in here and I'll eat them myself.
And so Benjamin Franklin, the humorist and statesman, got himself a warm place by the fire with no fuss, no bother. Can you imagine that? Comes time now for another of our Can You Imagine That musical oddities. We all like to play detective, and now we're going to give you your chance to do a little melodic snooping. If you ferret out the clues, you can award yourself a bright badge and a diploma complete with fingerprint outfit. First, let's listen to a composition of the immortal Frédéric Chopin, whose delicate musical traceries have left him undying fame. While you're listening to it, try to figure out what popular tune of pre-war days sounds very, very much like it. Are you ready? Then listen to Chopin's Fantasy Impromptu in C-sharp minor. Catch it? Well, we're not going to give you another chance on the Fantasy Impromptu, but here's the popular tune of pre-war days. We're sure you'll recognize the melody, but if you don't, the lyrics will tell you all about it. Listen.
I'm always chasing rainbows, watching clouds drifting by. My schemes are just like all my dreams, ending in the sky. The fellows look and find the sunshine. I always look and find the rain. Some fellows make a winning sometime. I never even make a gain. Believe me.
it is, the closing item on another session of Can You Imagine That? But we'll be back with you soon on this same station, and we most heartily invite you to be with us at that time. Until then, this is Lindsay McCarry saying goodbye now.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.